12 Who Shaped San Diego, a series of radio programs on local history, biographies of 12 great men and women who have left their mark on today's San Diego.
He had had so little as a child, and his father never gave him anything. He never inherited a cent, and he wanted to do better by his children than he'd been done by. He was a very competitive individual. He made each one of us children competitive with each other. He instilled that in us.
Ed Fletcher came to San Diego as a young man. In his lifetime, he was active in the development of water supply systems for this region. He was a highway promoter and land developer, and later in life, a state senator. Ed Fletcher is the subject of this 11th program in the series, 12 Who Shaped San Diego. I'm Peter Hamlin, and joining me is Dr. Claire Crane, San Diego historian and chief historical consultant for this series. Now, Claire, the first thing I'd like to ask you about is the importance to San Diego's development that Ed Fletcher had, and also where does he fit in? We're now on the 11th biography of our 12, and where exactly does he fit into the growth and development of the city of San Diego?
Fletcher was a tremendously important developer, particularly, of course, in the county, because of what he did in developing the water systems, which served the county and also the city of San Diego, and the land developments that were associated with those. He was also important as a developer of roads in the area, and then he played a role. After he was 60 years old, he began his political career, which is quite remarkable, too. Then he served 12 years in the state Senate, and while he was there, he was responsible for important legislation dealing with, of course, water, one of his favorite subjects, and land, another subject, and introduced the legislation that made it possible, subsequently, for the city to develop Mission Bay Aquatic Park, the finest of its kind anywhere in the world.
To begin our story of Ed Fletcher, we turn to Ed Fletcher Jr., his eldest son, who became involved with his father's company back in 1917. His father first came to San Diego at the age of 15. The year was 1888.
Well, the reason he picked on San Diego was because he had a sister living here, and he had decided to leave Massachusetts because his father was coming back from Florida and was going to farm him out as an apprentice. Under the laws of Massachusetts at that time, until a son was 21 years old, the father could farm him out as an apprentice and take all his wages. And Dad decided that he'd had enough of that. He was going to leave, and he bought a scalper's ticket for $20. And I don't know whether you know what a scalper's ticket is or not. What they used to do, people out here would advertise in the paper in the East that they would furnish transportation if they'd come out and look at real estate. And then the people decide, oh, they didn't want, after they'd sent him a ticket, then that he'd buy that ticket from somebody at a scalper's price. The ticket cost them nothing. But Dad bought one for $20 and came to California. First thing he did was go up to the San Diego Trust and Savings Bank and deposited $5 that he had. That was his total capital with M.T. Gilmore, who was the teller at that time. And he just said, well, this is where I'm going to stay. And he found out in talking to him that Gilmore came from Maine, so he was a New Englander just like Dad. And although Gilmore was considerably older, they liked each other, and so Dad struck him up for a job. And he scratched his head. He said, by golly, I got a dirty basement up the house. He told him where to go up on 6th Street where Gilmore lived, and he'd go up there and clean out that basement for me. And that's the first job he had.
Ed Fletcher, in his memoirs, says, my next job, the following Monday morning, after working for the Gilmores, was for $5 a week, working for the firm of Johnson & Patterson, plumbers. I was an awkward, overgrown boy, he says, and broke 18 lamp chimneys on Tuesday. Friday, I put a 2-inch brass water faucet high on the shelf and not too securely. Mr. Johnson came along and just happened to be underneath when a jar of the rack forced the water faucet to fall and hit him squarely on the head. We carried him out unconscious and bleeding. That Saturday night, I was fired and sobbed most of the way home.
Well, it's interesting you were saying how chance circumstances happened to mold the development of history, and that caused him to go into a different line of business, didn't it?
Yes, as a matter of fact, perhaps that was a lucky accident that he didn't stay in the plumbing business, because he was then hired on to work for a produce merchant, and in the process of going out into the backcountry to make contracts for produce, he became aware of the tremendous significance of water and the possibilities of developing land if it were well irrigated.
He used to go out, get his bicycle, take it down to the depot, put it in the baggage compartment, and he'd go to Oceanside on the train. He'd get out, and he'd cover Oceanside, various stores there, and pick up, orders for materials and stuff and produce. He'd go out to the farms and buy up their crops, their honey, their hay, their grain, and it was while he was riding his bicycle all during those formative years that he realized that certain streams ran late in the year. So he knew just where the water was because he'd have to ford these creeks. He knew where the cold weather hit because the sumac would get frozen. He knew where the land was going to be the most valuable because it wouldn't freeze the crops. Mm-hmm. So that's how he got interested in water.
He soon found out through later business associations that land and water development were intimately related.
The South Coast Land Company was back in the 1907s and 8s, long in there. Dad went up to Del Mar and built the Stratford Inn Hotel. He was manager of the South Coast Land Company, built the Stratford Inn Hotel, built the swimming pool, which was an enclosed, bathhouse. And the power plant, because they didn't have electricity there, they put in their own power plant. Then he went up to his Rancho Santa Fe and drilled some wells and pumped the water in a pipeline clear down up to the top of the hill back of Del Mar. Mm-hmm. And the very first summer, Dad sold over $1 million worth of lots. He used to bring people down from L.A. by the carload, a full train load,
uh-huh.
And serve them their luncheon and take them up the hills and show them lots. My father, of course, would buy the land up cheap when it didn't have any water, and because he knew that he was going to bring water to it. And like building Lake Hodges Dam, he interested the Santa Fe Railroad to W.E. Hodges of the Santa Fe Investment Company, and Ripley, who was president of the railroad at that time. They put up the money because Dad showed them how putting water on that 8,500 acres that they owned of Rancho Santa Fe, that it would become valuable, and it did. And then, of course, the city of San Diego was running short of water, and so he built a pipeline from Lake Hodges clear into La Jolla and a pumping plant there at Torrey Pines to stave off a drought in San Diego. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we furnished water for months. When Otay Dam went out, we furnished all the water that the city had from the old San Diego Flume or the Cuyamaca Water Company from Lake Murray. So all those things showed that water is king.
Yeah.
Water and roads, those were Dad's pet projects. Mm-hmm. Water and roads.
And so Fletcher, with his intimate knowledge of the county, began to develop that formula for successful land development. Claire, I'd like to discuss how Fletcher originally got into the actual water supply business. That was about 1910, wasn't it?
Well, as far as getting into what he renamed the Cuyamaca Water Company, that was in 1910. He was interested even earlier in the development of the San Luis Rey River and also of the San Dieguito River. And later on, Henshaw Dam was built on the San Luis Rey River and Lake Hodges on the San Dieguito River. But the San Diego River, of course, was the city of San Diego's only source of water for a good many years. It was wells were drilled into the San Diego River, and as Elizabeth MacPhail tells in her book about Alonzo Horton and the story of New San Diego, a company named Hoke and Smith would take the water out of the San Diego River and put it in barrels and drive through town and sell it to people. It was sold in barrels and buckets, and she quotes someone in her book as saying the water was terrible. First we boiled it, then we strained it, then we boiled it again, and then we drank something else. So the San Diego River was San Diego's only source of water in those years, and when the population grew so tremendously after the railroad was completed in 1885, a company was started called the San Diego Flume Company. The flume, a flume is a wooden structure that is an aqueduct, essentially. And this company, in 1889, constructed a dam up at Cuyamaca and then built this wooden aqueduct, the wooden flume, which ran for 35 or 40 miles, bringing water by gravity from Lake Cuyamaca, which is the headwaters of the San Diego River, down into town. And that was the only source of water then for a number of years until the city of San Diego then made an arrangement to purchase water from the Southern California Mountain Water Company, which had been developed by Babcock and then later was owned by John D. Spreckels. At first, the city of San Diego was just purchasing water from that system, and in 1906, the city gave an exclusive contract to the Southern California Mountain Water Company, and as a result, the Flume Company lost its biggest customer and virtually went bankrupt. But the assets were still there. The flume was still there. The water was still running. And Fletcher, in 1910, bought up that system.
About that time, I met James A. Murray from Butte, Montana, and Mr. Murray had a lot of money, and with Dad's know-how, they bought the San Diego Flume Company for $125,000 from the English bondholders, and that was one of Dad's first big steps going into debt. And from then on, he owed $1 million or $1.5 million for the next 30 years. You never could get off from under it.
There is an anecdote from a Fletcher family vacation in those early years that further demonstrates the quality of the water at that time, which further interested Fletcher in the need for better water in San Diego.
We stayed on Central Avenue in Lemon Grove. Mm. And in those days, you couldn't drink the water without first boiling it and then running it through a sieve and then straining it, because you'd get polywogs and you'd get garter snakes that come right out of the faucet. And that made Dad mad. He says, the Lemon Grove Mutual Water Company said, we can do nothing about it because that's the water they give us out of the flume. So that was the start of his development, I guess. He got the idea we've got to have better water.
All day I faced a barren waste without the taste of water. Cool water.
Water.
Old Dan and I, with coats burned dry and souls that cry for water,
water,
cool
water,
clear water.
Ed Fletcher bought the Flume Company, and it was renamed the Cuyamaca Water Company. The Cuyamaca Water Company was later in the vortex of an important water rights case, which has been important to the development of water rights law in San Diego. And to fully understand that case, it's necessary to return to the early days of the Southwest under the Spanish flag. Because of our history, we inherit two legal systems, the British and the Spanish, with different points of view on the subject of water rights. Dr. Iris Engstrand, professor of history at the University of San Diego, explains that the early Spanish settlement of this area has had a whole range of influences on San Diego's development.
Probably the most important area was the river or the water supply, which was in common for the people living in the town. Each person had the same right to the water and also the people in the outerlying areas. Their irrigation system was such that you could divert the river. You had a right of passage over someone else's land in order to irrigate your own fields. But it was a sharing in common, in contrast to the English system, which we know of as the riparian water rights, where the people on the river owned the water. Here, all the people shared equally.
It was the Cuyamaca water case, eventually decided by the Supreme Court, that determined certain water rights for the city and the Cuyamaca Water Company, owned by Ed Fletcher. And, Claire, I'd like to ask you, what was at issue in this case? What two sides were represented? What was at stake?
Well, in an extremely oversimplified way of saying what the basic issue was, Iris Engstrand has pointed up the difference between these two legal systems. And the Spanish system in regard to water is summarized as first in time, first in right. That is, those who have the first claim, the first time, the first chronological claim, have the prior rights. Whereas Anglo-Saxon law is based on what's called riparian rights. That is to say, if you own the land alongside the river, then you have a claim on the water of that of the river there, rather than somebody who may have had an earlier claim but does not happen to own the land, the watershed right along the river itself. So, in part, this was the issue at hand. And the city attorney of San Diego, Cosgrove, and later his assistant city attorney, Shelley Higgins, and incidentally it's in Shelley Higgins' delightful book called This Fantastic City, San Diego, that I got most of this information, and it's very, very entertainingly told in Shelley Higgins' book. They contended that the city of San Diego was the legal heir of the old Pueblo of San Diego, and that the Pueblo, in turn, was the heir, you might say, of the first settlement, the Presidio and Mission. And they contended, therefore, that the city of San Diego had the paramount and prior right to all of the water of the San Diego River from source to mouth. And while they said that they did not want to use all of the river, that they would not deny access to it to other people, they wanted to establish legally that the city had the paramount and prior right, because Cosgrove contended that if they established that, they would then be able to sell the bonds, which would enable them to build the El Capitan Dam and to develop an extensive and expensive water system. But he felt that they had to establish their paramount right, although they would not deny other people, like the Helix Irrigation District and the Cuyamaca Water Company, the right to get water from it. And this battle went on for about 10 years, I guess. It began in the 1920s and was not finally concluded until 1930. Fletcher had by this time sold out the most of the Cuyamaca Water Company assets to the La Mesa, Spring Valley, and Lemon Grove District, and it was actually the district which owned the dam site for El Capitan Dam, which was something that Fletcher had located. The judge did say that the city of San Diego did have the paramount and prior right, except that these other companies, in particular the Spring Valley, La Mesa, and Lemon Grove Irrigation District, had the right to take a certain amount of water out of the system, and that they would always be guaranteed that they would get that amount of water.
William Jennings was a lawyer for the side of the Cuyamaca Water Company, and he remembers Ed Fletcher, a colorful man he says was the consummate promoter.
Well, I would say that that describes him very well. He was a promoter. Fletcher was an optimist. Everything was always going to go right as far as Fletcher was concerned. And going right meant that there would always be some water that he'd get from some source to fill the needs of his family and his real estate holdings. And, you have to admire the man. I always liked him. He's a very likable chap. Tall, dignified character. But he could get down and bargain and divide up with water that he had no rights to at all and supply an area with it. I was fortunate. He knew my father, and when I first came down here to San Diego from Los Angeles area where I went to school, I went to work, amongst others, for the what was called the Mesa Lemon Grove and Spring Valley Irrigation District. And that happened to be a pet of Fletcher's. He owned practically all of the undeveloped land in the district. And he was a great one to operate it, and if he needed to bend the rule a little bit, he would bend it a little bit, because what was more important than that this area get its water? Well, so he was the lifesaver for all of us that were dependent upon the water here. And we quarreled with him and bickered with him, because being the person who was responsible for it all, he also wanted to run it. And one of the things that he wanted to do is tell everybody how much they could have, what the price should be and everything else. He was a little king of this water arid Western California. But nevertheless, he was a man of a great deal of energy and the daring to try anything. I mean, tell him, well, gosh, Colonel, we can't get by with that, you know. I mean, there's some limitation to what we can do. Oh, no, not if we need the water. If we need the water, we can get it and we can use it. And so we always had some as long as we listened to the Colonel, and which was until he died. I used to be a member of his firm, the Higgs Fletcher law firm. And I found myself greatly in conflict with the firm, because I was always a supplier of water for public use to a large number of people, and had the idea that I had a trust interest in preserving the water and preserving the water right and all that sort of thing. So anybody felt that way was going to run afoul of the Colonel now and then, and I ran afoul of him now and then.
William Jennings saw the Cuyamaca case to its conclusion. He was the attorney for the Helix Water District for many years. He also was involved in the County Water Authority and the California Water Commission, and developed a reputation as a top authority in water rights law. By the way, Lake Jennings is named for him. It's his feeling that the question of water rights is still a difficult one, one that is still far from a definite and final solution.
It's still, there's as many opinions upon who has the basic right to the water as there ever were. And the thing that most of us, I think, have learned is not to advance any claims for the water. The water, we all have a usufructory right, a right to make use of it as long as it's available. If we overuse it, then we run out of water. Just think of the distance that water is brought from the original Colorado River to the city of San Diego. Unbelievable troubles and problems. And we're still, we've made great steps towards preserving that water supply and litigating and planning and working out conflicting rights to it, but it's likely to blow up in our face any time, just any time, because water is the lifeblood of this country, and we've got a very small and limited supply of it.
San Diego attorney William Jennings. The realization of the fact that water continues to be a problem in this area is struck home again and again. First, there's the recent Western drought. And there's been a legal dispute between California and Arizona over rights to the Colorado River supply, which currently brings San Diego about 95% of our water. City Attorney John Witt and Assistant City Attorney Robert Tease explain that case.
Arizona established its right to take the waters of the Colorado River as opposed to California's right, which had, you know, used the Colorado River for all these many years. And the decision in that case brought about our Feather River project and our now California, extensive California water system. And our right to take the waters of the Colorado River are gradually being reduced to a level which won't sustain us if we don't develop the Northern River water sources.
As Bob has pointed out, because of Arizona's victory in Arizona v. California, we will be continually receiving a diminished supply from the Colorado River. But I think that the rights as between the two states have been settled by that case. The rights to the San Diego River water were settled in the Kiameka Water Company case way back in the 1920s. The Los Angeles River's been recently settled. There was a dispute involving Camp Pendleton as to water in the Fallbrook area, and that one has gone to litigation and been decided in, the late 50s or early 60s. And all I can say is that another dispute may arise as to a different water course, but as to those water courses, I think we've got it pretty well nailed down.
I should point out that probably, maybe in the future, San Diego's water problems will be solved by making seawater conversion economical. When Arizona will take its full entitlement of the Colorado River is also speculative. In order to take their full amount, they'll have to develop the central portion of Arizona over the next couple of years. And how many people will be living there is one for the good Lord to meditate upon, I suppose, because whether it'll entice people to move to the central portions of Arizona simply because they've got Colorado River water, I don't know.
Assistant City Attorney Robert Tease. Before him, we heard City Attorney John Witt. Even if the flow of water from the Colorado continues, other problems are foreseen. The water is currently pumped over the mountains to San Diego. The cost of energy for this pumping will be substantially higher when the contracts are renegotiated in 1985. And so the cost of that water will also be much higher. Before leaving the subject of water rights, we must mention one group that has consistently complained of unfair treatment in water rights cases, the American Indian. Many cases that have been contended still remain unresolved, according to Roy Cook, who teaches American Indian Studies at San Diego State University and Grossmont College. But there is one recently resolved legal case that has been successfully brought through the courts by the El Capitan Indians. Roy Cook tells us that this case involved the El Capitan Indians and the Helix Irrigation District.
And the Capitan Grande Band had maintained that for many, many years that there was a section of the land which had been taken and has been used for these last 30 years, which restitution or no money was ever given for it. They said they bought a certain amount of land, and they just took that piece. Well, there was a ruling that not only would their fishing rights be recognized, but also that, yes, that land was taken illegally, and a judgment was ruled against the water district and in favor of the El Capitan Band of Mission Indians. That is a precedent-setting case, and it's to my knowledge, is one of the first ones, especially in Southern California, which has come out with any sort of success, or any, at least for Indian people.
Roy Cook adds that this case points out what many Native Americans have been saying for a long time. There's no need for new laws, but existing laws and treaties must be defended. Well, the water issue is a complex one. There are conflicting claims on the parts of different groups, different municipalities, and among advocates of different uses of water. And the importance of water to San Diego is made even greater by the fact of our semi-arid climate. For these reasons, the San Diego Historical Society has begun work on a project that would make material relating to water development more easily available to researchers. They also hope to publish and display our water history for the better understanding of the community at large. Tom Scharf is involved as managing editor of publications, and Charles Hughes is the archivist for the San Diego Historical Society, who begins the description of the project, the subject it covers, and the role of Ed Fletcher, whose papers will be an important part of their work.
If they didn't have the water resources, then they couldn't sell the land, and that's how he gets involved in both aspects of it. Then you had to make the water development pay off by developing the land, but you couldn't develop the land without having the water resources available then. We think water development is a very important aspect of San Diego's history and development. So we're going to be developing a program in which we would be creating a water resources archives for the San Diego area as a whole then. And these documents then would be deposited in this archives, arranged, sorted, indexed, cataloged, and made available to researchers then to do research on water development. And in this way, we hope to increase the understanding, the appreciation of the importance for the conservation of water resources in the community then.
Aside from making this material available to researchers, does the Historical Society have any particular plans for projects here to somehow do something with the material after it's indexed?
Well, one of our main projects is going to be a traveling exhibit, which we hope to exhibit in a number of different schools around the counties, showing the history of the development of water in San Diego. Also, several articles which will probably appear in our quarterly magazine, the Journal of San Diego History. And then we hope to do a very large book. I don't know how large, but we'd like to have one of Southern California's historians or leading experts on the history of water development write it. And we would illustrate it with a number of the photographs which we have so far been collecting from the Fletcher collection and other collections on the history of water development in San Diego and probably all of Southern California, really. And this, in combination with the traveling exhibits and things, would hopefully enlighten a lot of people as to the history of water in San Diego. It's very hard for a lot of people who come from the East Coast to visualize what San Diego would have looked like if not for the present development of water that we have.
Ed Fletcher was a promoter, a dynamic individual with a natural-born gift of a salesman. His land developments had led him to an interest in San Diego's water supply, but roads were another key to the success of his land holdings. Russell Crane is a member of the San Diego Highway Development Association. It was begun by Fletcher and some others in 1935, and the group continues to meet today. Russ Crane was with the Fletcher Company for 21 years as an administrative assistant to Ed Fletcher. In fact, he was for a time charged with the duty of driving Colonel Fletcher to various places in the county, which turned out to be the source of many stories about Fletcher.
He was almost like a school teacher, really. He would explain to you as you went along how this happened and why this happened and why they did this and why they did that, and he would hum little old tunes once in a while. I'll never forget one day I was driving him. He was 6 foot two or three, and he was sitting in the front seat. And oftentimes in automobiles, you know, those front seats aren't built for a 6 foot three. And he crossed his old leg over and started to pound out a tune on top of my foot, which was on the accelerator. And if you don't think we didn't go down the road in a pretty healthy speed.
Many of our present-day roads and highways go back to Ed Fletcher.
On these roads, he had a tremendous sense of what could be done and what couldn't be done. And when they built the concrete ribbon of road 20 feet wide, which is the highway that goes from San Diego through Ramona and Santa Isabel to Julian, well, they knew darn well that if they started it and they maybe would get as far as Ramona, and they'd run out of money, and that's all she wrote. So what he actually did is he got them going from both ends. So as they were running out of money, they were getting closer together, so they went out, and by public subscription, they got more money and finished the road. Otherwise, the road would have never been completed. And that's the way they did a lot of those things in those days. The Mountain Springs grade road on Highway 80, which was the one that really got the road going over the mountains into Yuma. They actually built that Mountain Springs grade road with public subscription for money. They had a big picnic out there with cars and people sitting on the back of the cars, and they auctioned off and got the money. People pledged the money to build that Mountain Springs grade road. And those are things that they could never do today, but that's how they did things in those days.
There's one anecdote about Ed Fletcher that shows his early interest in the direct route to Arizona. This was back in 1912, long before a proper road had even been considered for this route, and most people were content with getting there via Los Angeles.
Well, this was kind of funny. This is one of the things he used to talk about when we were driving around together a lot, and I thought it was quite interesting. There used to be an automobile race from San Diego to Phoenix, and the only stipulation with the race was the first one to Phoenix won the race. So they always started off in front of the Grand Hotel and the Plaza in downtown San Diego on Broadway. And, of course, when they fired off the gun for the race, everybody went down down Broadway and went out, went on out and up Rose Canyon and on up toward Los Angeles and across that way, which was where the roads were to get to Phoenix. Colonel Fletcher went down at the end of the street, made a U-turn, and came back and roared through the crowd and went on out the back way through El Cajon and through out through Ramona and down the San Felipe Wash and across the desert, across the sand dunes. I think he either waded across. He knew how big the river was at Yuma. He either waded across the river or else he took the tires off and went across on the railroad track. And then on the other side, he put the tires back on, and they went overland then across the desert to Phoenix and won the race by 10 hours. And so after that, they had to make stipulations of how the direction the race would go.
Yeah, didn't Colonel Fletcher develop a plank road through the desert just to show that it was... that this was a better route, a shorter route?
Yeah, that wood was brought down on big barges from Northern California and was turned over here at Benson Lumber, and it was shipped to the valley, and the plank road was made. There's a piece of plank road now that you can see on the Caltrans property, about a block up from Taylor Street on Juan Street, and it's very interesting for people to go by and see. That was just the width of one car, and every so many feet or a quarter of a mile, they would have a off ramp where people could look ahead and see a car coming. They could pull off and not have to get into the sand.
We've examined Ed Fletcher's interest in highways and in water development in San Diego. And Claire, I want to ask you about a rivalry that began in the early years between John D. Spreckels and Ed Fletcher, and I understand the rivalry had to do with both highways and water development.
Yes, it certainly did, and of course they had political differences as well. Spreckels was one of what was called the Old Guard or Stand Pat Republicans, and Fletcher, along with George Marston and other people, was active in developing the progressive wing of the Republican Party in San Diego. And although Fletcher himself did not become active, that is, as a candidate in politics until later on, he initially got started with the campaign in 1910 when Hiram Johnson was running for governor of California on a platform of, I'm going to kick the Southern Pacific Railroad out of California politics. And, of course, Spreckels was tied in with the Southern Pacific Railroad, among other things. So that was one source of their rivalry. And of course, the water system that Spreckels had developed in the southern border area of San Diego County had been purchased by the city, and this bankrupted the Flume Company, which Fletcher later bought up. So they had conflicts over water, and in the Fletcher memoirs and elsewhere, you read about the conflicts that they had over road development, too. Spreckels wanted, of course, to have more roads developed through the southern area of San Diego County because those would benefit his vast property holdings in that area, in the Jamul and Otay and Tecate areas. Fletcher, on the other hand, had property interests in the northern part of the county, and so he was more interested in getting roads developed there. And although they had a good deal of rivalry in a lot of things, they also often worked together. And I think one of the interesting things about that earlier period in our history is that sometimes it was possible for people to be what you might call friendly enemies. Fletcher says this himself in his memoirs. He says, "It was a joy to live in San Diego at that time. We often fought each other politically, but we also frequently worked together when it was in the best interests of the city." And he gives examples, for instance, of how they all worked together, Fletcher, Marston, Spreckels, and a lot of other people, to help put on the exposition in 1915 that was so important to San Diego's development.
In the 1930s, Ed Fletcher was persuaded to go into politics as a candidate, but he didn't forget about his vast land holdings. In fact, they provided part of the reason for his interest in running for state office in the first place. This is how Ed Fletcher Jr. tells it.
I think, frankly, business was so poor, and although the job only paid $100 a month as a state senator, and you had to furnish your own car, it was an honorary job, he felt he could go up there and create some laws that would help to save the property that was going to Lincoln for taxes. That was his primary interest. Of course, He had to pay an awful lot of taxes himself, and he couldn't help but help himself. Mm-hmm. But in helping himself, he was going to help all these people that were losing their properties because they couldn't pay the taxes. So he helped put through those laws the moratorium on taxes and the 10-year payment plan and the 4-year payment plan. And he did a lot to help the people, you know, save their properties.
One important part of San Diego's history in which Fletcher played a part as a state senator was the development of Mission Bay. He sponsored several pieces of legislation that facilitated the development of the park. The entire effort was spearheaded by Glenn Rick, who served on the city's planning department from 1927 to 1955, with only a brief period away from San Diego. It was around 1929 when Mission Bay was made a state park. Glenn Rick saw its development from a hardly navigable river delta to the recreational park that you can see today.
In 1930s, I had drawn some sketches of Mission Bay, and in 1943 and 44, the city council felt that this town was going to be a ghost town after the war, and it was feeling pretty well held by a number of people. In fact, articles in national magazines said that San Diego was undoubtedly going to be a ghost town, and they thought San Diego's industry would be folded at the end of the war. Well, Mayor Knox called a meeting of the Chamber of Commerce and some citizens, and I was asked to give a talk about Mission Bay as a possible job-producing item that could be developed after the war. San Diego needed Mission Bay, and the only way to get it was to ask the state legislature to transfer the tidelands and submerged lands to the city of San Diego. Shortly after that, the city decided that the development could take place only if we had some money, and a $2 million bond issue was proposed.
Fortunately, that bond issue passed with a 71% vote in favor of it.
Mm-hmm. And had the land then was already transferred by the state to...
It took place about the same time, and about the same time, federal legislation in the Rivers and Harbors Act called for the development of San Diego River flood control.